This is a production of Cornell University.
Everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. Feel free to get your food and take your seats whenever. But I'm going to go ahead and call a meeting to order. AA will take roll. Just let us know you're here, whatever's called your name.
All right. First, Adam Howell, present.
Here.
Christy Mahoney, here. Brandon Fortenberry. Brandon Fortenberry. Here.
I'm answering for him.
Kate Zifron, here. All right. Tarek, not here. Sharon Leparco, here via Zoom. Anthony McCabe, not here. Hey, the Pew, here. David Heiner. And Ellen Miller,
here.
Christopher Barth, not here. Ann Severding,
here.
Craig Wiggers is not here. Marcy Benda, not here. Jennifer Michael, not here. Andrea, right here. Rigel,
here.
Laura Taylor, here. Jessica Withers,
here.
Kirk Sheldon is here. Andrew Brooks,
here.
Carrie Sanzone, I think she indicated she would be on the Zoom. Brian Goodell, not here. Josh Cooley, not here. Jackie is here. Ashley Miller, is here. Mary Newhart, here. Emily Ivory, not here. Rob Michael,
here.
Jamie Long, not here. Jessica Family is not here. Stephen Perry?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Can you hear me?
Includes roll call.
All right, thank you, everybody. We have quorum. First of all, can I get a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve.
And he's seconded by Laura. Right. Thank you.
I'd like to.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I should be calling for additions or changes.
I am, at least I know of, Craig was present for the meeting and we were present.
Okay. Unless there are any objections, we will note that change. And yes, Andrea.
I was here via Zoom.
Okay, all right. Any other changes or updates to the minutes from last meeting?
I'm trying to remember if I was here.
Does anybody remember a
thing too? I don't remember.
Feel free to go in your
Okay.
Unless anybody has any objections, we can amend the minutes by unanimous consent. So we'll move into business of the day, but first I did have an announcement from Craig, just kind of like a health notice, but he wanted me to remind everybody and encourage, have you all encourage your constituents to think about getting your measles vaccination. They're occupational health on the first floor. You have to make an appointment. It takes only 10 minutes, but good reminder for this time of year. So, but beyond that, we're going to go ahead and get right into the business of the day. Please expand on measles.
So if you know you've had your measles vaccination when you were younger and you have an attestation of that, that's great. If not, either go to get a measles vaccination or you can go to your doctor and get a titer. But the university has gotten notice that in the event that there is a measles case, everybody will have to show that you have either one or the other. And if not, there's like a 21-day quarantine. So it's serious. There's if you go onto our website, the cornell.edu, and just look up measles, there's a fresh information. But share that information, please, with your constituents.
Do you mind emailing me that? And I will also remind everybody.
Absolutely.
That's really important information to share with constituents. I wasn't aware of that. So yes.
I just got my titer, and the doctor said, "Oh, people have been lining up from Cornell, and I'm good, but you have to be able to." Show that
you've had
your
very important
vaccination. The titer is just it's a blood test that tells whether you have the you're vaccinated against measles.
Andrew, then Andrew.
Yeah, just because it's a component of that for folks with autoimmune
conditions that's recommended that you don't have the
antibiotics.
Oh. So depending on that. So some of the constituents that I serve is part of the disability rep. I think there is a component of it, but the titer might be the way to go for folks who can't receive the live vector. And that's a good question to ask whoever is monitoring us what the options are.
I mean, I've had measles.
Mm-hmm.
So, presumably, I don't have any record of that.
Very good question. I think
antibodies.
Will the titer show somehow an antibody?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. Maybe I'll do a little bit of research from health services and get a comprehensive amount of information to put out so that we can all redistribute answering some of these questions. Or if anybody has any info. Anyone else? All right. Let's move on to our presentation on the campus constituency elected trustee. Bruce, would you like to go ahead?
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Bruce Lewenstein, a professor in the Department of Communication and Science and Technology Studies, and one of the two faculty elected trustees. I want to thank the EA for inviting us to come make this presentation. With me is Mike Esposito, who's also a member of the CCCET, and Kate Supron is the EA appointed member of the committee. Normally, this committee consists of essentially the trustees who are currently elected from the campus constituencies, specifically the student and employee and communities, and then appointed representatives from the assemblies. So normally, Jeremy Kruser would be on the committee. Part of the, as we established this new committee, one of our principles was that if you think you might be running in the election, you can't be a member of the committee. Since Jeremy is fulfilling a shortened term and is considering running in the election that will be coming up next spring, we invited Mike, who's a former employee elected trustee, to join the committee. Next slide, please. So this committee, you may remember a previous committee called the Trustee Nominating Committee. That committee had existed for about 25 years, and its functions and procedures had changed, and in the process of sort of cleaning things up, we said, you know, let's just start fresh. So we have this new committee on campus constituency elected trustees, which primarily, its primary goals are to recruit candidates and run the elections, especially for the student elected trustees and the employee elected trustees. Faculty elected trustees are managed by the dean of the faculty's office. So there is going to be an election coming up next spring for an employee elected trustee, and some of the sort of key, what we're trying to do now is begin to get information out so you can be talking to your constituents and the communities you interact with to start building interest and people can start asking questions. Our goal is to try to have this happen organically over time rather than, oh, there's an election coming up. What do I do? Which typically is what happens if there's sort of a last minute announcement kind of thing. So for the employee elected trustee, the key points are that any regular full-time employee in a non-exempt, exempt, or academic non-professorial staff is eligible to run and is eligible to vote. There's certain circumstances in which they might not be eligible to run. There's certain exclusions for people whose jobs involve university-wide authority where it would be inappropriate to be on the Board of Trustees because of conflict. That's the basic set of communities. Mike raised the issue of the change in the RTE faculty, research, teaching, and extension faculty, and sort of where do they fit. You may know they've recently been incorporated into the Faculty Senate representation, They will have the ability to vote in the faculty elections, although not to run in the faculty elections. Postdocs, it looks like they will probably be able to vote through the employee, for the employee elected trustee, but not to run. Whatever it is. Three assemblies and 14 different kinds of people. So, for the employees, it's one of the key things is being able to confirm with the supervisor that you expected that you have reasonable expectation of being employed for the 4-year term. That would mean either that you're an at-will employee with no expectation of your project ending, or that you're on some kind of long-term contract that extends past the end of the term. This question comes up because there are people on short-term contracts who have no way of knowing whether they're going to be renewed. And perhaps, especially if it's on soft money, there's no expectation. Also have to check with supervisors that they're willing to give employee elected trustee the flexibility to perform their duties. That involves being off campus occasionally for meetings, sometimes during the day, having to attend meetings. And, you know, finally, we are trying to get candidates from all the constituencies and all the campuses.
Mike, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think one of the reasons why we're coming here is because it's such an important role that the employee trustee has, and it's very integral to the employee assembly. The next issue, I think that the employee elected trustee is a conduit for some of that information that goes forward to the board. They may not hear from administrators, so it's really, really important that you're really involved in that.
Yeah.
How long is the term? The
term is a 4-year term. Yeah.
What is the actual, an estimate of the time away and number of meetings?
So there are 4 board meetings a year in October, January, March, and May. Only the January one is held in New York City. The others are all held here on campus. There are committee meetings, subcommittees of the board that usually meet in the day before the regular board meeting, day or two before. Occasionally they will have a separate meeting. Many, especially for committee meetings, it's not unusual to have people call in. That's happened. The other activities are, that's the, you know, official obligations. The other stuff is being an ex officio member of the EA and, you know, expected to come to these meetings, being on call to show up for other, in this case, employee related activities. The constituent might. There is a committee called the Trustee Campus Community Committee, which meets basically as anybody who's local to the Ithaca campus, meeting with community members, with some community leaders on a regular basis. That happens about once a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not a question, but I just want to expand on it. We have several new members, so I want to expand on one or two points, and correct me if I'm wrong on them, but all of you are eligible to run in this. It would result in a change of your status on the employee assembly. You would vacate your seat and become an ex officio member. But it is important that the staff elected trustee is an ex officio member and has a relationship with the body. The other thing I would like to mention, and this is where you might want to correct me if I'm wrong, but the experience of being the employee elected trustee is somewhat different than your experience here, in that you sign a confidentiality waiver and you are not able to speak in as openly about your activities on the board as you would as an EA member. And that's very important in considering when considering this role and when communicating it. It's not as public of a role in terms of your ability to talk about the work of the board. And that's just something that people should be aware of. It's distinct from our role, as we are very open. We want to communicate with our constituents. Again, I very much hope that you all communicate this information out to your various constituents. It's important that we have a robust election and a good amount of knowledge out there about this process. I'll put this in my email to staff, or to all of you. But that's just a nuance that everybody should be aware of. And if I'm off on that, please.
Well, no, so that's actually, I put up this next slide, is the trustee role. You are a full voting member of the Board of Trustees. Come and I will say that the Board of Trustees highly respects the input of all of the campus constituency elected trustees, but including the employees. It means you have a fiduciary duty, and your obligation is to the university as a whole, not to the constituency that elected you. And part of that, then there are these other obligations, like the confidentiality one, that, you know, that our discussions are private. It doesn't mean you don't talk to people and you gather information, you talk about what are the big issues on campus that people are worried about, the details of what's happening.
So that can be very difficult because you are the person that the police will call if there's an issue that they want resolved. Parking, red button woods, things like that. But again, and that's a really difficult pill to swallow, because when they're approving a budget, you know that means raises are going to be low for staff who work so hard, but you also know that money has to go elsewhere for very legitimate reasons. So it's a lot of decisions like that are really difficult to make, but you make them on behalf of the university looking 100 years forward. And I will say a little thing, a little bit more about the time commitment. Whatever you prepare for the meeting, I mean, there's a lot of reading. You really have to be up at the highest level on what's going on for now. You'll get probably put on gene searches. I've been on 2 presidential searches, and so I fly all over the country for the whole semester. So the time commitment can be significant, and you should really know that before you go into it.
The other thing I'd add to that is this: you get a vision of the university that's very different than you get from any individual. I mean, I'm a faculty member. I've been here for 32 years. I've learned things about the university that I just had no clue about the interactions, the intersections, the ways the different parts of it. Fascinating. Yeah.
Jeremy's filling a role that now we're looking at starting a 4-year
term. Exactly. So Chad Coates was elected to a 4-year term. 2 years into his term, he took a job away from the campus, so he resigned, had to resign his role. So Jeremy was elected to fill the unfilled part of the campus.
And Bruce, if I might just interject real quickly here. The other thing when Bruce is talking about a different perspective on the university, one of the perspectives that I think changes significantly is your view of the board itself and the administration. You get to see some more of why decisions are made the way they are. Sometimes they're not always our favorite decisions, but there is a need to learn and better understand the broader view of the university. And a lot of that becomes a lot clearer as you take the time to understand from a larger perspective what the university is trying to accomplish at the end of the day. One of the things that I found really reassuring upon meeting the board is that the members of the Board of Trustees they're not paid by the university. The reason that they are there is they are genuinely interested in the best outcome for the university. The relationships that I've begun to build with those trustees has really been of great benefit. So.
Questions either from online or
Can you just confirm, I think you said RTE staff can run?
So, no, RTE faculty can vote, will be voting for, in the faculty elected trustee election, which is also going to be held this year, my son, and against the second but they can't run as candidates. Because,
okay.
Yeah.
So, can they run for any?
They, no, but they can't run as candidates under the employee. They're in an odd situation. They've been given more authority than they had, but not yet.
Other questions?
Next slide.
So the other thing that I wanted to do is just say a little bit more about the committee and just give a little bit more context for us. So it is this committee for campus constituency elected trustees. Our role, as I said, is to get news out, get information out, answer questions, and generate interest in both candidates and the election itself. And then we have a role in managing the election, although the details are handled by Gina, who runs the entire university out of her office.
Wendy,
Wendy.
Any questions you have?
Right.
It's called
access. So the actual, day-to-day technical management is run out. And I think one more slide, I think. And just give you a sense of the process. So this committee was just established at the October board meeting. And so we're running a little bit behind, but our goal is that in the future, the committee will begin at the beginning of the academic year. We'll set an election schedule and we'll start having a couple of information sessions, meetings like this one. Then at the beginning of the spring semester, have more information sessions. There are a couple of detailed meetings we hold where people who actually want to be candidates and want to know more about nuts and bolts, the election, and then if there are any challenges that happen to be some specific election rules and challenges. I don't know, has there ever been a challenge in the employee? Yes, there have been challenges in the employee.
Yeah. Is there just one faculty elected and one employee elected?
No, there are two faculty elected and one employee elected and two student elected. These. Yeah.
Historically, how many people have run for the employee seat? On average.
Yeah.
4 or 5. But this is a new day. I think the idea behind this committee is to really reach the corners of the university that might not have known that this was an opportunity.
Is there going to be a webpage where we can drive people to eventually with all this information?
Yeah, there will be. There's already a page for the employee elected trustee, sort of just generic information about the role. And then as we move to the election process,
has there ever given any thought, since there are two faculty representatives and there are two student representatives, to having two employee representatives?
Yes, I actually went back and looked through some old minutes to find that. I can't remember when it was, but yes, there was an explicit discussion about adding a second employee elected trustee, and the board decided to add that.
Okay. To clarify to that point, there are two student elected trustees. In alternating years, there's one as a graduate professional student, and then the other alternating year is an undergraduate. So they each are, there's one for each of those specific
institutions. And certainly, is it sheer numbers of students, sheer numbers of employees?
I wasn't there, so I don't know the exact details. We have a very large board. There's 64 people on the board. That's a very large board. And at various times there are. Some of the other things in the minutes are attempts to shrink the board. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened yet.
So when the board decided to craft each of the constituencies elected on campus, they got past the seats. So there were two employees, and it became five. So they were faculty, then it became two. And what they did is have a 44-member board, and then a 22-member trustee council. Which was sort of a holding pen for people to get. That made them very upset. They made it a 64-member board again. all of those extra seats went to the board's selection. They were not returned to the constituent.
One thing that, but they will consider in certain circumstances. So as you may remember, there was a complex set of challenges to the student elected trustee election last spring. And one of the ways that that got resolved, one of the actually the way it got resolved was the board used one of its selected seats to so that both candidates essentially won. Solving a particular problem, but it does mean there's a precedent for using those board selected seats to serve other folks.
But it will also say that that one member is just makes it more integral to the employee constituent. They all go to when they have questions.
And it's just an extra tidbit. Cornell is sort of unique in that it has full voting members from its constituencies. That even having one employee elected trustee and two students and two faculty and then some alumni elected trustees as full voting members is not common. So, and you know, to the point of shared governance and constituent representation, it's really, really, it's a great thing. It's something the university has a long history of endorsing and supporting, and it's integral to the governance structure that Cornell has.
The last slide. Any other questions?
So I would add one additional thing to that last question about the numbers, and as Bruce noted, I think that the saying two students, one staff, and two faculty is a little misleading because we have one undergraduate student, one graduate student, one staff, and two faculty. And when we're talking about that, we need to think about what the purpose of those roles are, and the purpose of the constituent elected trustees is really to provide that perspective to the board. When they're selecting trustees for the board of trustees, this isn't really a meritorious award to recognize you. This is a job position. You're doing work. And the purpose for the constituent elected is really to provide that perspective from your constituent groups. So as an employee, it's to bring an unfamiliar perspective, one that most of the trustees don't hold, which is living locally, working the job here at Cornell. And part of that's maintaining connections to the employees and maintaining a good understanding of the issues that we face. One of the reasons why I try to make as many of our meetings here as possible is so that I can share those perspectives upwards. Having an additional employee would only really be useful if there was an additional value that that employee was bringing, same with an additional student or an additional faculty. It's about what work is that person accomplishing on the board.
Jeremy, can our members reach out to you if they have
absolutely. Please do.
And more information later on?
Absolutely. Please do. Don't hesitate to contact me directly if there's any information that I can provide, any support that I can give.
Excellent. Well,
Mike or Kate, anything else? Great. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. All right. Moving right along, David, would you like to give us an update on the ICTE survey?
Sure. I'm going to take control of the screen if that's okay. So as you know, we talked last time, the survey had, I think, just closed or was about to close. I have now had a chance to go through and finalize the survey results, download them, slice them between the different populations across campus. And what I did is I broke them down to students, regardless of graduate, professional, or undergrad, staff and bargaining members, faculty and RTE, And you can see that students were the highest group that responded, with faculty being the least. However, the response rate would say something different. So faculty were, in terms of the population size, were number one in the response rate. Staff and bargaining were number two, and undergrad were, or students were the lower end of the spectrum. In terms of, you know, what our population does in terms of smoking is, you know, we're a pretty healthy campus. Not a lot of people smoke. And we can see that here, even though we only had about 5,000 responses out of 34,000 participants or people that were offered the survey. I mean, you know, we can kind of, you know, make a blanket statement that, you know, people are relatively healthy and making right decisions. What is interesting, though, and this is also the same for electronic use cigarettes or nicotine. What's interesting is the perception that people smoke is much higher. So it kind of makes you wonder if there is a, if there's a perception that there's an issue of people smoking across campus when there maybe isn't. And this trend also, I've been working with a guy from Tompkins Smoke Free, and he said this trend is, you know, the same as any national survey that's done. So this isn't unique to Cornell. It's nationally, people aren't smoking, but there's a perception that a lot of people smoke. And the trend is also the same for electronic use cigarettes. And so if we keep going, most people don't, well, sometimes to all, secondhand smoke. Most people aren't exposed to secondhand smoke or vapor aerosol when they're going across campus, which kind of contradicts the first slide, or not the first slide, but the previous slide. But if we keep going, this is about the consequences of secondhand smoke to you as a person. People strongly agree that they are concerned about it, and rightfully so. And the same trend is for others in terms of even outdoors. They're concerned for others as well. And the same trend is the same for electronic cigarettes and for you or when I gave this presentation yesterday at the university assembly, I thought this question was a little misleading. So the reason why I think it's a little misleading or just a poorly worded question is there was no, like, it didn't matter to me. and this is, if Cornell had a smoke-free campus, would it have made a difference? A lot of people said they would be excited. Some people said I would have looked elsewhere. Most people probably just didn't know how to answer the question and just left it, I don't know. But it's useful to see. I think most people would be excited, but I don't know that it made any difference. When I started 12 years ago, I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to go work for Cornell. Who cares? I'm just excited to be there. And then this is what we've all been waiting for. So if Cornell were to enact a 2 to 3 year process of establishing a nicotine or a tobacco-free campus, would it have an overall support? And the answer is, yeah, most people would somewhat agree to strongly agree that Cornell should move towards this direction. What that means, for
how we move forward with the university assembly. I'm uncertain. There's still a lot of conversation happening within the committee and also the UA as a whole. I think we just were starting the conversation yesterday, but there will be a resolution that will be put forward, whether it's, you know, recommending Cornell more or enforces the 25-foot rule from buildings a little bit more, removing the cigarette butt cans away from the doors and putting them in designated spots that are away from buildings, and, you know, offering more robust cessation programs through Cornell Health. And, you know, on that topic, there was a lot of open-ended questions. So this is, or not questions, text. This was the open-ended text of the survey. You can see that, you know, people, common words show up like free, bad, hand, which could be secondhand smoke, those kinds of things. And there's like 3,000 comments just through that, and I just started going cross-eyed reading them. There was also an online public debate that I did also a Wordle for. Now, I did actually manage to get through most of those comments and read them. And one of the things that stood out in those comments was so most people aren't necessarily for a ban in that the open comments, but most people just want to see an enforcement of the 25-foot rule, have designated spots, you know, just being courteous if you smoke, go someplace else, maybe go to a hidden spot. I don't want to say that you know, smoking is like a the stepchild you put in the corner that nobody sees or anything like that. But you know, just, you know, moving it away from the public eye and, you know, exposing other people to it. So I would say there was about 2/3 that want to see stricter enforcement of the 25-foot rule from buildings. And then there's about 1/3 that want to say, no, we should just ban it because I have asthma and it's affecting me and, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of where we're at. Any questions?
Yeah, real quick before we get to questions, I just want to say thank you to David for all this excellent work on this. This has been something that has been kind of ongoing for a long time, stalled, I would say. So to get to this point where we have this great data, thank you very much for all your hard work on this. I know it's a lot, so appreciate it. Any questions?
Sure.
As a staff member that did do the survey, I just want a clarification. I've heard tobacco and nicotine interchange a lot, and there are some differences for me, personally speaking. Tobacco pertains to cigarettes, cigars, chewing tobacco. Nicotine, those three, and the vaping.
Right.
So, just for consistency sake or clarification, would it be a nicotine ban, or would it be if it does become an effect?
So it's my understanding that it would also be nicotine, so the e-cigarettes as well. Chewing tobacco is
disgusting.
No, like the nicotine gum. That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that's part of a cessation product. Right. So I don't know if that would be considered. But the aerosol vapors would.
How much conversation has been put into ideas like enforcement? If we're having difficulty enforcing a 25-foot ban, how would we look at enforcing a complete ban on campus?
Well, that's a good question, Jeremy. We haven't talked a lot about how we would enforce that. But there have been other universities that have done a nicotine-free campus. And what they've seen is that though people still smoked on the property, they respected the 25-foot rule a little bit more than what they did before. The flip side of that is you take away the cigarette butt cans and you have people throwing cigarette butts on the ground. So.
Other questions?
What's Cornell Health's perspective on vaping as a cessation of smoking, especially since there's not as much data on the health of it?
That's a good question. limited conversations that I've had with them, and this was last semester, they viewed e-cigarettes the same as smoking tobacco.
Anyone else?
As this moves forward into the resolution phase, is this a UA resolution, EA resolution, joint resolution, one resolution, everybody supports that resolution?
That's a good question. So right now it would be a UA resolution, but I would like to work with other assemblies to try to do a joint resolution if other assemblies want to get on board with it.
Anyone else?
I made a comment yesterday. We had this in the welfare committee talking about it. You know, the data, there's a lot of different ways you can dissect the data, but the one slide that says, how would you feel about it being a tobacco-free campus or whatever it was, is fairly definitive of strongly agree and somewhat agree. And that was the one where I kind of felt like, this is the data we have. I'm personally disappointed in my constituency, which is a lot of UAW bargaining staff members and the turnout in that regard. However, we gave the opportunity. I feel like it was very effectively communicated. I mentioned as well that the UAW staff put it out in their newsletters. They spoke about it quite a bit as well. So the opportunity has been given for folks to give input. And the input, well, has bits of pieces of textual data. There's a definitive slide that says most people would agree.
Right.
So if we have nothing but data to go upon and the data says this, what other option? What is the weighing of the option? What did the assembly UA say in regard to weighing the data?
I think there's still some open debate on how we would draft a resolution or what the resolution would say. There is sufficient, I don't want to say sufficient data, 5,000 responses out of 34,000 people is really not a large response rate. It's, 14%. I still think there needs to be a lot of debate. I think we would probably draft a resolution that would recommend Cornell do a feasibility study of offering cessation programs, how we could, you know, further enforce the 25-foot rule. Most people, I don't see Cornell police going around enforcing that or anybody really enforcing it. So it might help to start reinforcing that rule and then see what it would take for Cornell to actually enact a nicotine use ban. So I don't want to say that we're going to recommend that Cornell ban cigarette, but actually just recommend that they start doing a feasibility study on it.
Anyone else? All right. Well, thank you very much again for your hard work. Keep us informed as the UA moves along on any actions.
Will do.
All right. So moving forward in the agenda to incidental vacancies, as you all know, we've made it a priority to fill incidental vacancies, and I'm really, really excited that we have Jessica Townley joining us today from Geneva for this seat. Jessica, you have the option to make a statement to all of us before we go into the voting. If you'd like to just briefly introduce yourself, we all have your statement. You provided last meeting, but feel free to take this time, and the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Jessica. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. Jessica Townley. I'm in Human Resources here in Geneva at Cornell Agritech. We recently changed our name, but I work very closely with pretty much everybody here on campus. I'm probably the one person that knows everybody on campus just because everything is run through me. And I just thought, you know, we've been having this topic brought up about the EA vacancy in our executive committee meeting for a while now. And I was recently promoted into my HR role just over 2 years ago. And you know, and now I feel like I'm seasoned in my role a little bit and, you know, have some room to take on something. And I think that this is a great opportunity for me to grow and also be the voice for here in Geneva. And it does help that I have contact with pretty much everybody here. you know, we are trying, I think we've come a long way since I started 5 years ago. But, you know, seeing Geneva more and more brought up, you know, even in the president's address and that sort of thing, I definitely feel that everybody really appreciates that here in Geneva, that we're not totally, like, off-grid. So I like to support that initiative, and I think that this is a great way that I can contribute to that. So, yeah, so thank you for taking the time to read my little bio and consider me.
Awesome. Well, if you don't mind, Gina, are we able to?
You want me to exit?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, does anybody have any questions for Jessica?
Okay.
If you don't mind, can we?
Do you want me to exit off?
Or you can just step away or mute us or something?
Yeah, can you talk?
You want me to just
mute us? Can I just minimize this or mute us for a second?
Okay.
We're going to move into voting, which is supposed to be a closed session.
Okay, I'll step out of my office.
But before we do that, I just want to once again, Jessica, thank you so much for all your hard work. We haven't had this seat filled since I've been on. I don't know how much longer before that, but I think this is great. The seat is there for a purpose.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Okay, I'm stepping out now.
But anyway, it's great that that we have representation in Geneva. So I didn't print off anything. We can just do a vote by placards if that's all right. So all in favor, please. Anybody opposed or abstentions? All right. Seeing none, I don't know how to tell them that we are. I guess when she comes back, we'll just say congratulations. Okay. Well, with that.
Are you done?
Yeah. Congratulations.
Okay.
You are our newest EA member.
Oh, thank you, everyone. I'm excited. I'll need probably a lot of advice, but I'll work through it.
All right. Okay, so let's move on to committee reports, communications and awards. Carrie, are you with us?
Hey. Yeah, I'm here.
Right.
How are you? Let's see. We have our upcoming meeting next Wednesday at noon on the 11th. So we will be reviewing some options that came in from vendors for promotional items, also trying to finalize the George Peter materials. I got a little bit of feedback from committee members. It's been pretty quiet, so trying to lock that down so we can put that out and begin receiving nominations. We've had some recently well-performing Facebook posts that I was pretty happy with, so I'd like to try to step up the volume on that, and specifically for the new members, would love to get a photo and craft your initial bio into something that we could share more broadly and just introduce you to folks as their new representatives. So I will be in touch about that, and that's my update at the moment.
Questions for Carrie? All right, let's move on to elections. Jessica?
So we just elected another and I don't expect us to meet again until after January.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Okay, hey, Executive Faith.
Hey, everyone. So I wanted to let you all know that mark your calendars, February 5th, 2020, President Pollack and Mary Opperman will be coming to Employee Assembly. So they do this about once every year they come. This is something that has been relatively new, I think, for the past two years. We have provided committee reports to them. Some of you who are newer might not have been here during that time, but each chair of the committee will provide an update to the president and to us all as a whole on some of the initiatives that we've been working on, and just an update on, you know, the work that's been happening. So I just wanted to give you guys just a notification that that will happen February 5th. So if you have any items that you want to prepare in preparation for that, that would be really great. Because I know the president really likes hearing from the committee chairs. This has been something that started at the EA, and I think she's requested other assemblies do it as well. So it's a pretty good moment for us to engage with the president. She's pretty, she's been very good at this process. She's asked questions. She's really been, you know, attuned to what we're doing here. So that's a good opportunity to engage with the president on February 5th, 2020. And we've just been working. I know that the priorities poll is something that we've talked about in the past. I provided a graph. We're still working on the written report, so that is still on the horizon. Our next meeting will be in the next in 2 weeks' time, so I'm hoping to get that prepared for that meeting. So that is the update.
Any questions for Hay?
Didn't she come at the beginning of the public comment at the beginning of the year?
Yes,
yeah,
she did.
Okay, so she's coming again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, just checking that I haven't.
Yeah.
She comes once a semester.
Once a semester. Okay.
Anyone else? All right. Let's move on to benefits and policy. Ann?
Well, we haven't met since the last EA meeting, but I have heard back from Alan Bishop that he would like to attend our next meeting, and I know he's going to be bringing some colleagues, and they will address questions that the EA has raised on career movement, paid time off requests, and the retirement 2-year wait for non-exempt employees. So, you know, that takes place next Tuesday at our regular BPC meeting. And one of the things that I forgot to report at the last one, that at our last meeting, it was just after Veterans Day, and there was a question about veterans apparently don't get the day off here on campus. And so there was a question about whether or not that should be something that we investigate or pursue, and Craig was going to look into it as a veteran threat. So I apologize, I forgot to report on that last time. We also have an ongoing question of the bereavement policy, and we'll have a discussion of that at the next meeting.
Questions for Ann?
What is the issue with the bereavement policy, that it's not long enough or not?
That it's broad enough, that the bereavement policy is very specific in terms of the days off for particular family members, but families these days are sort of different from, you know, the way families were or have been conceived of in the past, and it's very specific. You get 3 days off for a specific family member, but the person who raised the issue was given only a short time off for her great aunt who had raised her, because it wasn't a grandmother or a sister or a parent. So it's just a matter of broadening. And then there also have been, apparently in the survey responses, some queries about the length of time for bereavement policies if families are not so scattered. If, you know, if you have a family member who passes away and you've got planning and distance and, you know, there's a lot and the 3 days may not be sufficient. So
the
day,
each
way, really, to most of the day to get them.
Any questions? Yeah,
Andy. Going back to the veterans discussion, is it that it would look to a policy for everyone to get it off, or veterans?
I think the question was about veterans only. And I mean, I don't know how one defines veterans, if that's the veteran, him or herself, or family members, or how that way, but it was just brought up as I had a vet friend who had to take a vacation day to go down to the hall on Veterans Day, and that felt wrong. So it's just being raised as a possible question for discussion.
All right, anyone else?
If I might, for just a moment.
Yeah, Jeremy.
As a veteran myself, one of the concerns that has been raised, particularly around veterans and Veterans Day, as many veterans like myself take the day to go participate in veteran ceremonies like the Tompkins County Veterans Day Parade, et cetera, And we have to take vacation days in order to do that. And I guess one of the thoughts there is, particularly if we're going to be participating in community events as part of the Veterans Day celebrations, giving presentations or speeches during these things, that we shouldn't be taking a vacation day to do that.
Thank you. I think Craig, who is the EA representative for veterans on campus, had agreed, he's not here, he's not online. He had agreed to follow this up and get a sense of what veterans felt about this. And he was going to report back, but I don't know if that'll be at the next meeting or later on.
I would like to add that when I'm doing new hires, I always get asked that question if that's a holiday. Like, a lot, yeah. So I just wanted to add that, too.
Definitely an important issue. We'll be interested to hear what Craig comes up with, for sure. Any other questions for him? Okay. Let's move on to Employee Welfare Committee. Christy?
You might answer it. Guest Linda Kohlhau and Middlebury. That was a good discussion about the history of the employee survey, her role on it, her current role as the HR analytics lead, and then how she will be engaging in the 2021 survey. Learned through conversation that her role with HR is actually expanding. She'll be taking a greater role into health and well-being in general, and so she's going to kind of become a member of the committee and in lieu of or in light of the results of the poll, we'll probably have a lot more conversation around how we can work together to understand what it was staff were telling us in that pulse poll. Linda does a lot of other 10% sample polls that she's interested in advancing, understanding of just what did we mean or what did employees interpret of health and well-being. We were trying to put another meeting in before the break, but it didn't work, so we're not meeting again until later in January.
Anybody have any questions?
Wait, I missed who you mentioned. Who were you talking about?
Linda Kohlhau.
What's the last name?
C-R-O-L-L-H-O-W-E-L-L.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Two words.
Two names.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kohlhau.
Kohlhau.
Got it. That's Pennsylvania accent, I'm sorry.
No. I'm just composed, so that's my hearing.
Any other questions? I don't believe Marcy's here. Is anybody on the Education Committee who can give us an update by any chance? Or if not, we can just catch up with her next time.
I can't say that I raised with Linda for the committee's interest in adding education-focused questions to the survey. Okay. So I'm putting them together to see how that might look, what it might be.
I don't think we met
since the last one. Okay. Before we get into, open discussion, I guess this is part of it, our next meeting is December 18th, that's getting really close into the deep holiday season. If you're going to not be able to make that or something, kind of let myself or Hey know as soon as you can, because we may, and keep an eye out for emails if we don't have quorum and there's not a lot of the agenda we may end up canceling that. Just let us know of your plans whenever you can. Please.
Didn't Alan Bishop say he was coming to the next meeting? No, he's coming to the BBC meeting. Oh, on
Tuesday. Yeah. Currently, we don't have anything scheduled in terms of presentations right here for our next EA meeting. And I'm not saying that means that we won't have it or that we won't have more presentations. I'm just saying the holidays, I don't want anybody to show up to an empty room or anything. So keep an eye out on your emails. We have a few minutes here. Any topics or questions anybody wants to discuss? Yeah.
The CJC meeting was scheduled to meet for a three-hour meeting to finish on Monday and couldn't. So we are meeting for 3 hours this coming.
Chris, are you with us? Do you want to give any updates about the Infrastructure Committee on the UA? Or?
Sure. Last night, the UA the campus circulator resolution that I drafted with the help of the campus planning committee and the transportation department made it to the floor. So it was just an introduction to here's this resolution and here's the topic. That content and kind of presentation will come to the EA hopefully in the new year once we discuss it and pass it to the campus welfare committee, or the employee welfare committee. Generally, there was a positive response. Predictably, a lot of people asked about design decisions, which the resolution specifically tries to avoid. But there were a lot of, good questions that I just sent an email to the transportation department. David brought up that there was something that used to exist in like around 2008 where Cornell owned its own shuttles, and it sort of went away, and it seems like the historical view is that it didn't meet the demand or serve the purpose, so it's like what lessons were learned. We also gave an update from my committee, the Campus Infrastructure Committee, which meets today at 4 o'clock in Wild 221 for anybody that wants to like hang out and have super fun. We're discussing the topic of divestment, which I learned last night that the student assembly was working on a divestment resolution, and it looks like they're working on one with the help of the graduate and professional student assembly. So that's two of the assemblies. And then ours, because our committee is related to sustainability and transportation and infrastructure, IT, we're trying to figure out, personally, how do we make sure that we do this effectively? Because it was in 2015-16, all the assemblies passed this resolution, and the Board of Trustees came up with a criteria for the next time this topic was brought up. So we're really trying to work hard at meeting the criteria. So it's like, not just come with the same, set of demands. And it's an interesting thing. We have an English, the chair of the English department, Professor Caroline Levine, drafted a divestment memo, which goes into, sort of an update since what happened, what we knew in 2016 versus what we know now, and trying to make an argument. So today at the CIC, we're going to discuss further about what a potential resolution looks like, why this is somewhat important to the employee assembly is with the rules that the Board of Trustees set out to have a divestment resolution considered, all of the assembly bodies have to pass, at least a very similar version of a request for divestment for them to consider it again. Otherwise, it will land at the president's office, which is still notable, but the Board of Trustees ultimately makes the decision because they have the investment committee functionality. So they're really the ones that need to hear the message. It seems like there's generally support for both of those things. I guess one thing I can throw out there too is the Sustainable Cornell Council, which is like the new compilation mega group of all sustainability activities on campus. There is a carbon neutrality, which is I would say the top level one. I'm on the operations one. We're looking into issues of like how do we buy things in a smarter way, do things all together, make sure that our computers that the university buys are EP certified, because the university is really something around like 25 different individual corporations all working together. So we do some things together, and there's other things that we choose to do on our own. So we're trying to find different ways. There are topics of like food waste, transportation, and definitely procurement. Because even today it was discussed about like how many times you see a WB Mason truck on campus going to different places, and is that 50 deliveries? That could really just be two deliveries if we started to order things in a smarter way. That's just like one example of what the operations is doing. And then the education committee from the Sustainable Cornell Council, that I would say that their thing is everybody seems to know about it, but nobody's changing their behavior around sustainability. So like, what are we missing and what can they do to move this forward and make sure that there are real opportunities for education and change? So I guess those are my updates.
Chris, at your meeting tonight, can we, or I don't think she'd have a problem with it, but would Carolyn have any problem sharing her white paper with us to share with the other members of the EA? as kind of maybe a preface to upcoming resolutions or anything?
Yeah, I think I did send it to all of the UA members last night, and it was agreed that the UA members, which includes the chairs of all of the assemblies, are free to share it with everybody else. So it's your job to forward it, Adam.
Yeah, I'm going to that one. Okay, I'll answer some questions. Any questions for Chris or any questions on this? All right. Does anybody have any other things we're going to order? Yeah?
I just wanted to get back to the staff survey question. Is there any kind of sort of pre-planning process for us to actually have access to the results of the survey this time? Since the survey results weren't shared with the last survey, and that's created some concern among some of the constituents. I'm wondering if there's a discussion beforehand about how those results will be made available to the staff.
Yes, and the survey results are publicly posted on the university website.
So the full university.
Correct.
Yeah, but they weren't shared by you.
And we were told very clearly they never will be.
They never will be.
Not with anyone other than the deans of the university.
Anyone else?
I have some.
Back to the beginning, yes, we are discussing our ask in terms of, we were informed that on the 11th survey, there was effort put into thematically representing the comments that wasn't put into the effort in 16, and that we could ask for something like that. They had asked for information by unit in 11, and they were told no. And at that time, and seemingly reinforced recently, is that it's a dean's discretion to share unit level.
Carrie, did you?
Yeah.
Question?
Yeah, unrelated. But just coming off of the snow day. Oh, somebody's looking at that. Student's iPhone. Related to the snow day, I was talking with a couple of staff members yesterday, and just thought I would raise the question that came up, which was, how do we define essential staff? Because the message that came out when the campus was closed was basically, we're closed, but essential staff need to report, you know, based on, I guess, whatever they know they need to do. And my concern is that not everybody realizes or is on the same page as far as the definition of essential staff. Just in my division alone, there was a working group that I wouldn't have thought was essential that was told they had to work on Monday. And that meant work from home, basically, but nevertheless work. And my department was sort of instructed, well, you can casually work from home. And of course, my division is really all computer people. We're not on the ground, you know, on campus. So we can work from home, but there was some inconsistency, even within my small division, about how to interpret that message and whether we were expected to be online working or not. And some people took, you know, the campus is closed quite literally to mean like you can sleep in, you don't have to do anything, you're not working today. It's a snow day, right? And other people were not given that flexibility. So the question came up and I just wondered whether that's come up in any of your departments and whether it might be something we ask for clarification on. I'll just follow up to say, on top of that, I'm always concerned that the message that goes out is written to the staff member. You know, don't think about your safety. Don't do anything that, you know, makes you feel unsafe or whatever. But in reality, I feel like that many staff members are concerned about what their supervisors want them to do. And they're waiting for their supervisor to tell them in situations where maybe the university is not actually closed, but it's a really dangerous driving day, that the staff members are waiting for the supervisor to say, you should stay home today. Don't bother coming in. And some don't. Some do and some don't. And so I keep coming back to the issue of so much is left to the discretion of the supervisor. And I wonder if, aside from asking for clarification on who is essential staff and how do we define that, can we do more or encourage HR or whoever's writing these messages to be a little firmer and more direct to the supervisor with guidance for what should be happening? That's all.
Brandon left, and it's unfortunate because I think it would be great to have his perspective from a dining perspective, because I'm not quite sure, but representing FCS in the past and just being an FCS member, I know that custodians as well as other folks, and I don't know, Andy, from a trade perspective, when you were in FCS, if there was any essential, but people know, are told and directed as to, because we've had this in the past where people were questioning whether or not they're essential. People have come to work and gotten in accidents, and, there's all sorts of confusion about that. But I think there's been a real effort towards clarifying for people who's essential and who's not. And even if people are essential, I spoke to our second shift custodian last night, and I said, did you come in? And he said, I'm considered essential, but I took a day. And he goes, I chose to take it because I lived in Elmira, and I just was not going to do that. And that was his choice to be able to, and his comment was, interesting. He goes, from a housing perspective, he goes, it would be interesting for those of us that are considered essential that have to be on campus to see if there are any housing options to allow us to stay afterwards if the weather's bad or that type of thing. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting question. I doubt the folks at SEL have a whole bunch of extra rooms just to hang it out, but I think that's an interesting point to be raised to think about that for our the folks that are determined to be essential. And I think from a custodial perspective, I think it's crystal clear as to who's essential and what their protocol is. Because again, some people, to your point, Carrie, some people would love their supervisor to tell them to stay at home. But I don't know if everybody will have that. From a supervisory training perspective, I think that that's been a component of it, at least from an FCF's perspective, but I don't know if that's the case across the university.
I mean, it seems to me that there's probably several parallel things to be answered. There's the communications aspect, and then there's the sort of philosophical one and inside the people's programs. I know I work for the local roads program. If our audience doesn't want people on the road, then we all stay home as a measure of support. But in the interest of time, I think that, Carrie, Andrea, anybody else who's, I think it merits some investigation and seeing if there's ways to at least improve, communication on the issue. If you want to work on this a little bit offline, if possible, and bring it back up, I think there will be more snow days. So,
Sure. I mean, if anybody wants to drop me a line, or we could, start a thread on the list, or, just privately for now, whatever. If you have thoughts, I'm just curious to know if everybody around the table knows whether they're essential. And if you're...
how we start these projects, so this is good. Real quick, it's the last question.
So I think if you are an essential personnel, you are told you're essential and you know that. So if you don't know that you're essential, you're not essential. When I was applying for jobs at Cornell, one of the positions that I applied for was an essential personnel, and it was repeated multiple times throughout the interview process, like, this is an essential role, this is what's expected of you if you were to be in the role, are you willing and able to do that? And that was like very clearly expressed multiple times. So I think if you don't know, then you're not.
So okay. With that, I'll ask for a motion to adjourn. Second, wait. Chris. All right. Thanks, everybody. Keep the ball rolling on this, and we'll see you maybe not next week.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.